kids. Matt Segundo here, and it seems that we've reached our 40th show. We're a bit over the hill. It isn't as nearly as bad as my 40th birthday. Well, back then I was sitting in my private yacht, one of the last perks the radio stations gave me. I was contemplating going muff diving with a cocktail waitress named Virginia. She was 18 years my junior, and I wanted to know if the color of her pubic hair matched the bad red dye she had soiled her locks with. Well, I had a cardiac arrest before I could begin any exploratory efforts. The doctors told me after that to stop drinking, but I said no. And now, here I am today, a washed-up entertainer, enduring merciless taunts from Jorge and the eager beaver I refer to as our young, roving correspondent. Good or bad, this week's show is devoted to Harvey Pekar. He is a comic book writer, a jazz critic, and apparently not much of a drinker. Before our young roving correspondent embarrasses himself again by talking with Mr. Pekar, he did get a chance to talk with artist Dean Haspiel, who has illustrated much of Pekar's work, including The Quitter and an upcoming Vertigo edition of American Splendor. Well, it's clear that Virginia is too much on my mind. I'll let the interviews take me away.
Okay, so I am here with Dean Haspiel, or rather not here, by phone, the guy who actually drew and illustrated Harvey Pekar's The Quitter. Dean, how are you doing this morning?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Well, I wanted to ask you, first of all, how did you get hooked up with Harvey?
That's kind of a funny little story. When I first started reading comic books around age 12, I was a big fan of Fantastic Four and Shazam, Captain Marvel, that kind of stuff, Batman, Superman. And as I started to enter my mid to late teen years, I discovered alternative and underground comics. And one of my favorites was American Splendor by Harvey Pekar, and also Chester Brown's Yummy Fur.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that comic at all.
I'm familiar with Chester Brown, but not specifically that
comic.
Yeah,
that was like his first series, and he launched. It was kind of like his one-man anthology with Ed the Happy Clown, and then he went to some autobio, and it was a really cool little series. Anyhow, so I discovered the fact that I thought I was going to grow up to be like the penciler for Fantastic Four or something like that, and that was going to be my dream. And when I discovered that you could write and draw your own comics, and they weren't like, you know, company-owned, I was kind of blown away by that, and that kind of encouraged me to write and draw my own stuff later on. Anyhow, jump another decade, and I'm assisting Howard Chaykin on American Flag, and Walt Simonson on Thor, and Bill Sienkiewicz on New Mutants and Electro Assassin, and a bunch of folks. And me and my good friend Josh Neufeld decided to launch a two-man anthology in the spirit of Love and Rockets by the Hernandez brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And instead we called ours Keyhole. And while we were doing Keyhole, Josh contacted Harvey Pekar, sent some artwork, and got a couple of gigs to draw his stories. And I always joked that I was a better artist than Josh, and so I was like, hell, if he can do that, I can too, and I'm a big fan of Pekar anyway. So I sent Pekar a bunch of my samples of the kind of comics I was drawing then, and I heard nothing. I was like, what's going on here? Why am I not getting, you know, priority here? So I was kind of, like, freaked out by that, but I wasn't going to, like, bowl him over. So instead what I did is I wrote and drew a two-page comic called American Dilemma, where I basically wrote this little paranoid story about how I had sent stuff to Pekar. He didn't respond to me, and I kind of wondered what was going through his head. And I thought maybe he thought I was too, stylized, or maybe because I come from superhero comics that he didn't want that. And I then published it and put it in an issue of Keyhole and sent him a copy. And again, I heard nothing.
Ah.
And I was just like, I was flabbergasted. My ego was crushed. I wanted to work with the guy. So anyhow, I figured, okay, I'm never going to work with Pekar, c'est la vie. A couple of years later, I get a phone call one morning. I got woken up. It's a guy that claims that he's Harvey Pekar and wants to give me a one-page gig. Now, because this running joke of him not responding to me, I didn't believe it was him. And I basically kind of had a little kind of scuffle with him over the phone, this guy. And I was like, are you really Harvey Pekar? Josh, is this you, Josh? And he he basically yelled at me and told me to fuck off and hung up the phone. So the joke kind of turned mean, and I was like, wait a second, could that really have been him? So I called up my friend Josh. I explained the conversation I had with this guy. And, you know, he had used terms like, come on, don't you want to make some bread, man? And, like, that's why I thought it was also, like, fake, because he was using a lot of, like, the P-car, you know, words and whatnot. So Josh was pretty convinced it was P-car, told me I was a fool, gave me his phone number. I called up Harvey. It was Harvey. And by the end of the conversation, Harvey said, what do I got to do to, you know, convince you that I'm really me? And the only way he could do that was to actually give me the job. So that's how I met Harvey.
And I guess
it's like many years of me soliciting him, finally him soliciting me, not me believing it, and then getting this one pager.
And I guess things seem to work out, because you are now you did, of course, the Quitter. You're also on board for the Vertigo version.
Oh my God, it's bizarre what's happened, because before the movie happened, I had cataloged maybe 5 pages of collaboration with P-Car.
Well.
And then, while that was happening, I had been an assistant to Ted Hope, the movie producer, a couple of years before, and he's a big comics fan, and he's a huge Harvey P-Car fan. So, you know, light bulb went off over my head, and I called up Ted. I said, hey, you know, I'm working with P-Car on a couple of things. Would you, you know, like to talk to him about the possibility of making a movie out of American Splendor? And he said, hell yeah. You know, should I give him a call? I was like, well, let me call Harvey and see if he's into that. So I call Harvey, and of course, he doesn't believe anything. He'd also had many run-ins with other people wanting to make his movie that didn't happen. So I can understand his reticence. Anyhow, I convinced Harvey that this guy was for real and just to entertain a phone call. Well, a year and a half later, American Splendor, the movie, came out, and it was amazing, and it won awards, and it blew everyone away. And I guess what happened from there was Harvey was really, you know, appreciative of how I had made that happen for him. And he asked me, what can I do within reason to pay you back? And I was like, well, Harvey, you know, I've never done a longer work with you. I'd like to do something substantial, you know, something that really, you know, has both our names on it that will make some kind of an impact, you know, in your lore. And, you know, he thought about it, and we batted a couple ideas around. Meanwhile, while that's happening, this guy I had drawn a couple stories for the big books at DC Comics, mm-hmm. like the Big Book of Grimm, the Big Book of the 70s, all this stuff. They had this series. Anyhow, one of the writers was becoming an editor, and I got in contact with him, Jonathan Bankin, and asked if we could have a lunch meeting before he actually entered the offices. And I threw him about 3 or 4 different ideas. One of them was a collaboration with P-Car. And he was really interested in that. So we started developing an idea with Harvey, and that turned into what eventually became the Quitter.
I also understand, though, you were also extremely instrumental in actually getting Harvey hooked up for the Vertigo run coming up of American Splendor.
Well, that was just, like, that just made sense. I mean, what happened was this. So I did the Quitter with Harvey, and then meanwhile, I'm like his main guy, so we did a couple of comics, one for Spin, one for Playboy. We did a 16-page story for Dark Horse Comics, The Escapist Anthology. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were running the gamut all over the place. Our little, you know, I was like, you know, second to Crumb, as it were.
Yeah.
You know, and Gary Dumb and those guys who have done a lot of his work, his comics. So while we're sitting there, and like Harvey suddenly is getting like 4 book deals, you know, for Random House, and you know, everything is like a graphic novel these days. Mm-hmm. I kind of was reminded that some of my favorite Harvey P-Car comics are his short stories, mm-hmm. and not everything has to be as substantial as a graphic novel, you know?
Yeah.
So I talked to him about that. I was like, Harvey, don't you have a ton of little stories that you want to put somewhere, and maybe they're not like, you know, maybe there is no theme, that they're just very, like, American Splendor-esque, you know, like the whole anthology? And he was like, yeah, I do. I was like, well, what about, let's talk to a couple publishers and see who's interested in launching a new American Splendor comic, because I had been missing that. And so I had originally talked to Top Shelf, who was really interested, and then I thought, well, you know what, since we already have a relationship right now with Vertigo, and they pay a page rate, and they have their, you know, excellent marketing machine, and, like, everyone's behind the Quitter, they did so well, why don't I just poke into their offices and talk to Karen Berger and Jonathan Bankin about doing an American Splendor series. And they thought about it for about a week or two and said, of course, yes. And so, yeah, I guess you could say I was instrumental. Harvey joked that I'm his agent, so he's always calling me up like, okay, what are we going to do next?
Well, he spoke very highly of you. When,
yes, and we hooked up, and right now it's going to be a four-issue miniseries, I think starting in September. I've just completed the lead story for issue number one, and I'm going to be contributing, you know, to draw one story per issue. And Jonathan Vankin has lined up a ton of really good, not only some classic Vertigo artists, but also some of classic American Splendor artists from Picar Stable as well.
Now, I wanted to sort of ask you about how you interpret Harvey's scripts as an illustrator. And he kind of indicated to me that basically he sort of allows the illustrator to go ahead and set up the panels and set up the setup pretty much how the illustrator sees fit. So maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, working with Harvey is a daunting challenge sometimes, but it also allows not only a lot of freedom for the artist to work out the story, but also what it does is it makes the artist a better cartoonist, if that makes any sense. And you can tell by certain artists that Harvey works with who met the challenge and succeeded and who failed, and I'm not going to name names, and I don't have examples off the top of my head right now, but honestly, I think that a lot of success for Harvey's stories in comics is via the artist. And so, having said that, when I got this 62-page, you know, hieroglyphic rant from Harvey, I almost had a meltdown. He writes about 8 panels per page, and I knew I had about 96 pages to turn this into a graphic novel. And so on the one hand, it was scary, and I was frightened to death, and not only that, but this was like a really important story because it was basically, in comic book terms, the origin of Harvey Picar.
Yeah.
And so I knew I was going to cover about the first 30 years of his life. And, you know, so I was going to have to age him, I was going to draw him as a kid, I was going to do a lot of reference, and there's a lot of hopscotching around. Of in this nature of this story, Harvey just kind of like tells the story almost like a teleplay. So I had to visualize it and make it into a comic book. And thankfully, you know, Harvey gave me kind of carte blanche to not only paste it from his own words, but also, you know, show it visually. I mean, I don't think Harvey had any problems with any of the choices I made. And neither did the editor. I think they both really trusted me. And I grew as a storyteller during this project because I just learned a lot of tricks and a lot of shortcuts to tell the best kind of story, that is, show the best kind of story.
Well, like what kind of tricks did you...
I'm sorry, say it again?
Oh, what kind of tricks did you learn? I mean, what...
Well, you know, I mean, in this case, you've read The Quitter, I assume.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you know that there are like 2 or 3 page scenes where there's actually like you're inside Harvey's head while something is happening with action and you know, cause and effect. But then there's a lot of metaphorical things happening throughout the story where, honestly, you're just jumping from panel to panel. Like, you know, then this happened and that happened, and then you cut into a scene. So what I realized, because there's a lot of that, I knew that I wanted to introduce Harvey, the older guy at this age, at age 65, telling this story, and then go right to his childhood, and then keep reintroducing him as the older guy now, because I knew we would end up the book at, you know, his current age. And so that was one little narrative kind of structure that I imposed on the story visually. And then, like, if you're reading it, I knew which pages would be opposing, and I would show certain, like graphic metaphors between, like, Harvey as the young, like, bully, you know, feeding off this violence and, like, his rage. But then, like, often Harvey in his own writing would then regret that and later in age, and so you might see an older Harvey regretting those choices. And that was stuff that Harvey doesn't, like, tell me how to draw. It's just inherent to his script and storytelling, and I was able to pick up on that, and I thought it made for a really pleasant experience, or, you know, visceral experience with the reader. And honestly, and I've said this before, you know, in order to make this story work, in my job, I had to make the story mine in a way so I could make it yours to read.
Sure.
So, even though it's Harvey's story in his life, I had to put it through a filter that would make sense to me, so that it could then be presented in a universal way.
Yeah. So you found yourself, I guess, what I'm getting at here is you found yourself sort of organizing all the 62-page hieroglyphic rant that you're mentioning into sort of like a set of panels that's totally different from your standard kind of comic book script.
Oh, yeah, totally. No, I mean, working with Harvey is, in comics terms, is incredibly unorthodox.
Yeah.
And in a way, I mean, I guess I could equate it to his, you know, I love jazz, but, you know, Harvey's a jazz connoisseur. It's almost like a jazz riff, in a way, between mm-hmm. writer and artist.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, do you find yourself, do you find this to be sort of more work sometimes than it's worth? Because it seems to me that, you know, squeezing 62 pages into 90, as opposed to having sort of a set script that dictates panels, do you find it more freeing or more work or the
you know, really, every relationship I have with a collaboration and a writer is very different. I mean, traditional comic book writing, especially in franchise comics, like I'll get handed a Keith Giffen script for Justice League Adventures.
Yeah.
And he's like such a pro that he's really thought about like what's supposed to happen in each panel, and he's paced the whole story in a certain way. And, you know, it's left up to me to how to visualize it, you know, in layout form and graphically. But then there's that kind of story, which is just easy peasy in a lot of ways. You know, there's not much of a challenge there.
Yeah.
Then there's stuff when I write and draw where I'm trying to match the two between text and image and see what, you know, that derives. So that's the whole, you know, different process. And then working with different writers, you know, usually a comic book writer does give you a lot of information that you can use or not, and they, you know, will let you choose.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Harvey, he is just basically writing out of, you know, this entire text. So some of it sometimes gets a little redundant in the way he expresses a scene, and I'll go over that with Harvey and the editor. I'll say, hey, listen, I might cut this out or I might combine these two panels because this is saying the same thing, because, you know, sometimes Harvey doesn't think about, oh, well, visually, if you showed it this way, you don't need to say it. So, you know, that's just some of the editorializing we do, you know, behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But ultimately, like I said, I think what it does is it just makes me a better comic book writer in my art. Does that make sense?
No, totally, totally, totally.
And, like, there's a lot of acting going on because, you know, Harvey talks a lot. Harvey likes to talk, and there's not a lot of action. I think that the Quitter probably has the most action you'll ever get in a Harvey Pekar comic.
Yeah.
So because he likes to rant and rave and like, you know, basically uncover the minute details of life, it's kind of like it's a real challenge to make, you know, two people talking look interesting, you know, even just to sit down and draw it, you know, mm-hmm. much less have to read it as a reader. So that presents a bunch of challenges of how to approach and attack, you know, any kind of story he writes, including the one I just drew, which is a 20-page story. But, I mean, honestly, about a third of the story, Harvey's on the phone, and I had to make that interesting.
Gotcha. Now, the thing is with the Quitter, I'm sure that reference was probably more of a challenge since you're dealing with a, you know, further in the past.
Was really, really hard. And I got to tell you, thank God for the internet, man. I mean,
wow,
it is bizarre. Like, I think maybe 10 years ago you would have had to run to the library a lot or go on location. In fact, I think Harvey wanted me to come to Cleveland, Ohio, so he could drive me around to some of his old stomping grounds. And, you know, I wish I could have afforded that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically had to rely on me getting, you know, certain places and addresses and talk to Harvey about what he meant by a certain place and basically capture, you know, the intent of what he was writing, even if it wasn't exactly the right thing. So, but you know what? That's fiction, man. I mean, you know, that's why I don't call anything autobiographical. It's semi-autobiographical. Because, first of all, you're only getting one side of a story through the writer's version, and then in the collaboration with the artist, you're just, you know, I'm not going to get everything right. And if Harvey's okay with that, then I'm okay with that, because honestly, we're telling a story here that's more important than the accuracy of, like, a street, you know?
Yeah, gotcha. Now, I also know that you're working with Jonathan Ames on an upcoming project, which seems to me that are you actively kind of approaching people who kind of think outside your standard kind of like, you know, Justice League sort of hard?
Oh, yeah, well, listen, I just want to state for the record, I'm a huge superhero fan,
yeah.
Nerd, geek.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than a good superhero comic. In fact, I don't know if you read superheroes, but if you've been reading Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely's All-Star Superman, it's a treat.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big, you know, geek for that stuff. However, I think the comics publishing climate is not embracing my style of artwork.
Yeah.
And I don't even mean in the quitter, but just in general, the kind of stuff that I draw.
Yeah.
As, you know, superhero proper. And, you know, as much as I enjoy superheroes, I'm a well-rounded guy. I like a lot of different things.
Sure.
And I love, you know, a lot of, you know, true stories, true tales. So I do definitely seek other projects and other kinds of authors if I'm going to collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I just want to keep it interesting in my life, too.
Sure.
And thankfully, I bumped into Jonathan Ames about 4 or 5 years ago at a local cafe. And, like, right off the bat, we became friends.
Gotcha.
And that's been a really good relationship with Jonathan. He's one of my favorite contemporary writers, and I can actually say he's my friend.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we jive, and we tell a lot of stuff, and I got him turned on to comics a little more than he might have been. And, you know, he got into the idea, and in one way, he's kind of like me. He's kind of like a Renaissance guy. He just doesn't only just write columns or novels or, you know, put together collections of his stories. He's also a performer. He's interested. He's written some screenplays. He's interested in acting. I mean, he runs the gamut. He's right now, I think, doing a little show with Moby.
Yeah.
So, you know, and what I appreciate about Jonathan is not only his talents, but that he hopscotches and he's hard to peg.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like been my, you know, credo, is that I don't have a hit, so I don't have, like, my Dark Knight Returns or my Sin City. But, you know, if you look at my breadth of work, it's all over the place. And I think it's all fairly interesting, too. So that keeps me interested in making things, you know, happen differently. And now that comics have gotten a lot more play, and now the New York Times gave it the official nod, you know?
Well, in its own, weird way, yeah.
It's bizarre what's happened because, you know, I used to be embarrassed to tell people that I did comics, or, you know, when I was a kid, I was scorned,
yeah,
you know, by girls and adults, you know, all over the place, because that's supposed to be kid stuff, you know,
yeah,
power fantasies for 12-year-old boys. But, you know, comics aren't that only. They're everything, just like any other medium,
yeah,
you know, song, movie, literature, et cetera. And so what I'm really excited is the fact that comics, the form, has been embraced by, you know, everyone abroad, and now more people are looking into it. And, of course, that means there's probably a lot more competition and the potential for a lot more glut, unfortunately,
mm-hmm,
because it means that every publishing house is opening up an imprint, you know, to try to bank on making some monies off of this. You know, it's not a trend, but it could almost turn into one. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess.
But, you know, Jonathan appreciates the form. He loves what I do, so it only was natural that two of us would try to collaborate on something. And we approached the same editor, Jonathan Bankin at Vertigo, who's also looking outside of, you know, the comic stable to make comics. He works with a lot of different authors that have never written a comic. I think Douglas Rushkoff is one of them that's doing a comic called Testament right now from Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, Jonathan, we all sat down, had a conversation. Jonathan had a really good idea. He wrote a 13-page outline, and it's amazing. I mean, Jonathan already has the knack for telling great stories. And I think, again, it might be another case of me helping, you know, interpret something, but it's not going to be like the 62-page handwritten rant. I mean, Jonathan is really adaptable. He knows what makes a good story, and I can't wait for him to sit down and actually write the script out. Because come summer, I hope to hop on to, we're calling it The Alcoholic,
uh-huh,
and start drawing that, and that's going to be about 120 pages, hopefully to be released in time for fall 2007.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, that's going to be another challenge, but I have a feeling it'll be even easier because of the fact that, you know, we're going to work really closely, and he lives like 10 blocks away. So.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Dean. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Hey, thanks for doing this.
Okay, so I am here actually on the eve of the centennial of the 1906 earthquake, and I'm here with
the one, the only, Harvey Pekar, who has recently authored Ego and Hubris, who's also known for American Splendor. So, Harvey, how are you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
So, I wanted to ask you about Michael Malice and the origin of how you met the guy, because he originally appeared in an episode of our movie year, where he was trying to save his tropical fish, and now he's the hero of Ego and Hubris. So I'm just wondering how you two hooked up, and what, in your view, makes Malice sort of a Harvey Pekar story? What are the ingredients, perhaps, of a Harvey Pekar tale?
Well, I met Michael Malice in 2003. I think it was in August of 2003, when I was promoting the American Splendor movie. And he wanted to meet me. He knew a guy named Gary Lieb who had done animation on the American Splendor movie. He had actually been writing a book about a band that Lieb had been in when he was at the Rhode Island School of Design called Rubber Rodeo. So, you know, Lieb told him how to get a hold of me, and he came over, you know. And we got to talking, and the initial thing that sort of interested me about him was that he was a Jew from the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And I'm Jewish, but my parents are from Poland, and they speak Yiddish. I mean, they came in an earlier, you know, wave of immigration. And I grew up in a Yiddish culture, and the Soviet Jews, they don't speak Yiddish, and their culture seems quite a bit different. So I wanted to talk to him about that. That was one thing I wanted to find out. But then as I got to know him, you know, I mean, he just had the combination of ideas he had was really, you know, unusual. And, you know, I wanted to sort of get to the bottom of it. It wasn't that the stuff was contradictory, but I wanted to find out what his basic values were. And, you know, I've never met anybody like him. And it was really, you know, kind of not that easy to figure out where he was coming from. And he's also, you know, can be a very vindictive person.
Sure.
So, you know, but he takes pride in that. So though he's also a real bright guy, you know. And so, I mean, those are some of the things that I noticed about him right off.
Well, you were mentioning earlier about how he was a little bit different from you, and I think there was a Time Out New York review by Sarah Goodyear, and she pointed out that Malice was sort of the anti-Harvey, where Malice kind of reflects some of the qualities that aren't you. I mean, you're fairly humble, he's very sort of, you know, proud and egotistical, and Malice is optimistic. You're the gloomy guy, as you say, in the movie of American Splendor. So I was wondering, was this an effort on your part to try to sort of do something that was a little different from, you know, totally opposite from where you normally sort of wander? Or?
Well, I didn't. I mean, I think I, you know, it was something different because it was biographical, not autobiographical. But I wasn't thinking that, I never thought that he was, you know, like, you know, totally different than I was. We share some things in common as well as, you know, having differences, you know. One thing I like about Michael is that he really respects intellectual achievement and achievement in the arts and things like that. And, you know, he's a hard worker. You know, he wants, well, he's already got a book out, but he wants to, you know, write some novels and he's working at it. He doesn't play around. And, you know, I think that's good, you know.
Well, I was wondering if it was kind of a response, because this is very, his ideologies are very, very interesting. It's a mix of sort of, he starts off as Republican with a little bit of Ayn Rand thrown in. With a little bit of sort of anarchism sort of thrown in. But one thing that actually made him so fascinating for me is that he, there were some aspects of him that were very sort of, you know, despite his ugliness, he has a good deal of integrity. He has a good deal of autonomy. And it's almost seemed to me that this story kind of reflected kind of a, I don't know, maybe questioning certain sort of political parties that are kind of spineless right now. Was this a sort of an ideological exercise for you to sort of expose inadequacies in our current political climate? Was that one of the motivating factors of...
No, but I will agree with you about your comments. Mm-hmm. You know, he certainly, you know, is kind of, you know... a purist about his beliefs, and he holds on to them very strongly. Some people have talked about the fact that because I'm, you know, generally viewed as, and I think correctly viewed as, you know, being pro-left wing, mm-hmm. and Michael is a libertarian, which is considered a right-wing party that, you know, we are sort of opposites in that. But actually, if you get down to specific issues, we're not that, you know, that different. I mean, like, we both are real concerned about, you know, excessive corporate power. I mean, he doesn't just give, you know, business a blank check, you know, like a lot of right-wing people do. And, you know, he's against the Vietnam War. He's against racism. I mean, not Vietnam, I'm sorry. He's against the Iraqi War, you know. And so, in a lot of respects, his views on individual issues are, you know, are similar to mine.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a subversive streak and a sort of politically incorrect streak. I mean, like, there's the moment in this book where he, like, you know, just brazenly walks past the September 11th security. And isn't that a fantasy that a lot of sort of, you know, civil rights people have? And yet, you know, we sort of accept this kind of, you know, security that exists, even though, well, to what degree is it actually enforcing security and to what degree it isn't, you know?
Yeah, well, if you get on his wrong side, he really goes after you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as you saw in the book, he got this guy fired.
Yeah.
Which I, you know, think was a little excessive myself.
How is the real Michael Malice does differ from the Michael Malice that's portrayed in Ego and Hubris?
Well, you know, the time, you know, my experience is that he's always been a real pleasant guy. I mean, we've sometimes disagreed, but we haven't gotten into a big, you know, brawl about it or anything like that. And, you know, he's eager to please. And, like I said, I haven't personally witnessed the vindictiveness that he refers to. Although I can see him doing it, you know, going after teachers and bosses and everybody else.
So in terms of his story, you kind of just took his word as you were kind of noting it down?
Yeah, I took his word, but I also, you know, met some of his friends who, you know, verified what he said.
So for this, you sort of, you know, interviewed kind of or talked with like primary and primary people close to Michael in order to kind of round it out and get these details.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, like, for instance, one time I went to a dinner with him, and he brought a whole bunch of people that were bloggers like he is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was asking them or listening to them comment about Michael, and you know, they said that his you know, his view of himself was accurate.
I wanted to talk about the dialogue, or like the sort of, you know, the story has this kind of dialogue quality to it that's sort of semi-clinical. And I wanted to kind of find out where this kind of came from. It was sort of like slightly urbane, almost coming from some sort of like Damon Runyon kind of quality, because he's sort of an outcast, but he's sort of a demi-monde. And I was wondering, to what extent was this sort of stylized? How did you find sort of Michael's voice within the process of writing the strip, well, the comic?
That's Michael's voice. I just transcribe what he, you know, the stuff he said and wrote.
So did you tape record your conversations with him and then just transcribe?
Well, they were mainly, I got the information through, you know, through correspondence.
Oh, okay.
But
oh,
I,
oh, go for
sorry,
it. Go for
I'm
it.
Sorry. No, no, I guess I didn't have anything to say.
Oh, that's okay. Well, I wanted to also talk about like the sort of how you devise your comics, which are different from, you know, there's a specific like comic book script that I've seen. I also know that Bob Burden actually, like, he actually dictates all of his scripts, which is interesting. I didn't know that. But you actually, of course, do the sort of, you know, stick figure drawings and, yeah, and all that. And I was wondering if you could describe this process. And also, I was curious because a lot of the layouts in your American Splendor books and also in The Quitter are very sort of like four or six or very boxy. I was wondering what attracts you to boxy layouts and what your process is.
Well, first of all, the way I write stories is I write them, I write them with stick figures, like in a storyboard kind of style, with captions and with speech balloons and thought balloons, because I think that's, you know, it helps me time the story. You know, like if I want to drop in a dialogueless panel, you know, I mean, it's easier for me to see where it goes that way, things like that. As far as the boxiness, I don't dictate to the illustrators how many panels I want on a page. You know, I mean, because I feel like that's something that they've got to discover. I mean, and you know, as they do it, you know, and it depends on, you know, like what they want to put into it.
Okay.
So that the panel design is there, I leave it up to them, you know, and they like that, you know.
But when you draft out the stick figures, do you, you know, specify a specific page? Is it like a page per page, or is it sort of like a page it however you want, panel it however you want? Or, I mean, how does that work exactly?
Yeah. You know, we talk about, you know, how many pages we have, mm-hmm, or how many pages I'd like it to be. But, you know, beyond that, it's...
You want some water?
No, it's all right. I'm just... My throat's just permanently wrecked. Okay. But beyond that... I leave it up to them. I say, okay, if you can get it into 12 pages, okay, you know, and I've worked with these guys for a long time, and I have with most of them, the illustrators, mm-hmm, and I have a lot of confidence in them, and I also don't want to be, you know, dictating things too much, sort of like cut off their, creative impulses. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen an Alan Moore script, but they're extremely detailed.
Yeah.
And that might work real well for Alan, but I don't want to lay so much on on the artist, because I feel that you can't really know what the end result of your work is, or where your work is going to take you. I mean, you know, it may turn out that you may want to use more panels or less panels or something like that, or I mean, on, you know, per page or something like that. And so I mean, I leave a lot of that up to them.
So at this, have you sort of abdicated more kind of control to sort of, you know, to Gary Dumm, for example, or?
Well, I treat all of the artists the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, I just, you know, like when I have a guy like Crumb,
yeah,
that I work with, I mean, it's like, you know, it's no sweat. I'm not going to worry about it. He'll get it right. And a lot of these other guys, I mean, I really have worked. Frank Stack's another guy. He's just wonderful. And, you know, Joe Sacco, I've worked with him. Those guys, you know, they know what they're doing. And, you know, they can think on their feet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they, I let them use, you know, the brains that they have, you know.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about the last two books you put out, The Quitter and yeah. Ego and Hubris. Both of these books have very sort of layered narratives, lots of supreme attention to flashbacks, and they seem very, very kind of pointed and targeted in terms of telling the story. And I was wondering, are you spending more time writing them, or do you find yourself emphasizing the details more, or in really kind of telling a story? Do you just want to get the details right? I wanted to sort of see if you could talk about the sort of the way you've structured your narratives with these last two, as opposed to American Splendor, where the stories are all very good, but they're all interestingly sort of episodic, whereas these are sort of these very kind of thick, almost epic-like narratives compared to the previous yeah. ones.
Well, I hadn't, you know, previously had an opportunity to write long narratives like this. Mm-hmm. And I should point out, when I went back, you know, I've got an opportunity now to, I'm working on reviving American Splendor with DC.
Mm-hmm. The Vertigo thing.
Yeah, and I've written, you know, I'm supposed to do like four issues, and then they're supposed to, down the road, release them, you know, in over a 4-month period, and we'll see where we go, you know, from there. But in any event, the stories that I've been writing have been, you know, pretty similar to the ones I wrote in American Splendor, you know, earlier. So I think that, you know, the thing with Michael Malice, I mean, you know, a lot of that just depended on, you know, like what I got from him, you know, and I just tried to, you know, structure it and make it coherent and everything like that. The other story, The Quitter, is like, you know, some stuff I really hadn't treated very much in my work before, especially when I was a young kid. And flashbacks were, you know, really important to me. I wanted to get a lot of detail in there. Mm-hmm. It didn't take me a long time to write it, though, because the stuff was, you know, really fresh in my mind, even though it had happened years and years ago, decades ago.
You brag in that book about having, you apologize for bragging in that book for having a near photographic memory at the time. Did this kind of aid you to sort of write everything? Did everything sort of come back to you just like that? Or,
well, in this case, I just you know, the stuff that I was writing about was so important to me and had such a strong influence on me that, you know, I would have been willfully, you know, careless or something not to remember some of the things that happened. I mean, you know, I can remember them, like I can remember, you know, an incident that happened to Michael Malice. Actually, something similar happened to me. in the incident that that happened to him, you know, like he refused to. I guess a teacher asked him about. You know, like, I think it was, you know, she said he got something wrong, and he was actually right, and she was wrong, and she wanted him to apologize, and he wouldn't. He says, I'm not going to apologize if I'm right, and with my mother. You know, I got into a position one time where, you know, I had just about alienated just about all the friends on the street and stuff like that. So, you know, and I was telling my mother about it. And, you know, and I was sure, I really felt sure that I was right and that they were, you know, sort of like, that's, you know, like they had some kind of conspiracy going against me or something, you know. I mean, they just... you know, wouldn't accept me. So, my mother said, well, maybe, you know, maybe you should apologize to them anyway, because, you know, like, look at all the grief you're having, you know, being alienated and stuff like that. But I thought I was right, and I wouldn't apologize.
Well, you've also been similarly uncompromising and sticking with American Splendor for so long, and then finally seeing it pay off, both with the R. Crumb landing him to start out, who illustrate, and also the movie.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that there is, you know, if there's a kind of moral here, you know, it's to stick at it, I guess.
Well, that's true, but I should emphasize that I enjoy writing, and that's the main reason I stuck with it. I mean, if it had been, you know, a pain for me or something. But, I mean, I got very excited when I got into comics because I saw that comics had so much potential and people weren't using them. They were just using them, you know, to do superhero stories or, you know, maybe some cutesy little talking animal stories or something. And I thought, God, you know, this... whole big area is just being left alone. You know, anybody who even attempts to do something different, you know, is going to be doing something constructive. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, I just thought of before I started doing the comic stories, I was, you know, I had all kinds of ideas about how to be an innovator. About things that could be done, you know, like, for instance, emphasizing, you know, mundane events, which aren't even emphasized in prose, let alone comics, things like that. So,
why do you think there's a war on the quotidian, both in comics and in literature?
Pardon?
A war on the quotidian, meaning that people don't. A novelist that comes to mind who does actually chronicle the quotidian is like Nicholson Baker, who chronicles almost every single detail. If you've read The Mezzanine, I'm not sure if you've read that.
Yeah.
But why do you think there's such a, you know, that people don't want to sort of deal with, you know, charting regular life? I mean, what can you do? What can comic book artists do?
Take it for granted. But it just so happens that's the only kind of life I know. I don't know any other kind of life. So if I want to write, that's what I've got to write about. And I find a lot of interesting things going on. And, you know, you know, to a poor guy, losing five bucks is like losing $5 million maybe to a rich guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's that element of drama in the guy's life, no matter, you know, what social class he belongs to, you know. And so I just think people, it's just a kind of a stereotype notion that quotidian events are just too too commonplace to chronicle.
But in addition to a lot of humor, there's also a lot of pain in your work. Like, Our Cancer Year is one of the most painful comics I think I've ever read. And in fact, I wanted to ask you because, I mean, I liked the movie of American Splendor, but I felt that it really didn't depict the pain of, like, you know, of having, like, liquid seep to the back of a chair, you know? I mean, I was wondering how you felt about that and how you were able to sort of tap into that pain. Did you just kind of just say, no limits, or what's the deal?
Well, you mean about do you want me to comment on how I felt they depicted that?
Yeah, that, and also how the writing of Our Cancer Year kind of, you know.
That was one section of, well, Our Cancer Year, I was happy with the book.
Sure. Because
the movie, I was, you know, happy with too. I thought that it was pretty innovative, and you know, I was really surprised it was as good as it was, you know. But they, in the movie, for one, I mean, my wife didn't want, you know, she was really down on our foster kid's father. Mm-hmm. And she didn't want to, and her main concern was just that, you know, she didn't want to portray him in a nice light or a good light or anything like that. You know, I'm not saying she's wrong, but what she did was, you know, she was talking to the people who scripted it. They worked out something where the guy who was the artist for the Our Cancer Year was supposed to be Danielle's father. And that's actually not true. Frank Stack was the artist, and he didn't have anything to do with Danielle.
Yeah, I noticed he had a different name in the movie.
Yeah, and so it was just, I don't know. The emphasis were in that particular part of the movie was on something.
Getting the daughter or something like
that. Yeah, you know, like, so.
I know. I mean, but when I, you know, and I saw the movie again, and the thing that sort of struck me was, like, the pain of reading Our Cancer Year, of seeing what you're going through. You see it in the movie, and it's like Paul Giamatti, like, it's like a slight little tuft of hair that, like, rolls off his thing. But, I mean, if you read the actual comic, you know, you've got, like, deterioration, a major sort of deterioration of physical and mental condition. And I'm wondering if you felt this, you know, this truth that you portrayed in your comic, kind of, that wasn't really portrayed in the movie, was this perhaps a betrayal of that period in your life? Or,
I don't want to go to exactly. I didn't feel betrayed or anything, because the movie was as good as it was. You know, I'm not going to get mad because, you know, a couple of scenes didn't come up to my expectation. But yeah, you know, I think you have a point. I mean, if it was up to me, I probably would have emphasized the nuts and bolts character of having cancer more. You know, what it does to you, how you know it weakens you, and maybe even, you know, like, causes hallucinations and stuff. And the time, remember the time that I had cancer and a skin disease, you know.
Yeah.
And at the same time, and I was just like, I couldn't even lie down. I had to, because every part of my body hurt. I mean, the front and back of. So I would just go down on my hands and knees if I wanted relief, you know.
Yeah.
And not have my torso touch anything.
Now, when you wrote this book with your wife, I'm wondering, because this has a totally different feel from all of your other stuff, in the sense that it is just, you know, like I said, kind of like, I will tell you everything. Was Did the process of telling this story, was this probably the most painful thing you wrote, or did you set any rules, or was there stuff that you just refused to actually chronicle in Our Cancer Year? Or?
No, I mean, we pretty much, you know, we both had things we wanted to say, and we found enough room to put them in. You know, I mean, it was an over 200-page book, and... We pretty much got in what we wanted to. Wasn't, you know, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, like back and forth and negotiating between us, but we wound up both pretty satisfied.
Okay. Well, do you think you'll collaborate again on anything, or is this...
With my wife?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on something right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, we were talking when I was setting up here about the fact that you've been exceptionally prolific of late. And I was wondering, I know that when you retired from your job as a file clerk, yeah, that you were having issues trying to kind of get back into a routine. Is this prolificity? I guess that's the correct noun. Is this sort of a result from, kind of streamlining your schedule? Or do you have can you explain?
I'm just accepting all. I mean, I need the money. And I'm accepting... you know, just about all the work that comes down to me. And it's good for me, you know, to have something to concentrate on, you know, and keeps me from obsessing and stuff like that, like especially about money, you know, because I go out and if I go out and do the work, that's a step toward getting the money and it makes me feel better. You know,
there's one thing I wanted to talk to you about, and it's, you might actually be interested in this. I spoke with Chris Elliott, who was one of David Letterman's regulars, and he said one very interesting thing to me that you might want to hear, and that is that David Letterman essentially told him that if you have a persona, you should just be nothing but that persona because the audience will be pleased by this. And it's not just Letterman, but it's also a lot of people who, like, you know, you kind of paint over the gray areas of life. Why do you think art and films and comics sometimes resort to these kind of tried and true archetypes?
Well, because I guess it sells. I mean, I guess they found that, I mean, the great unwashed likes that. But I certainly don't subscribe to that idea. And as a matter of fact, that's one reason, you know, why Letterman and I had our, you know, hassles, because he wanted to keep me confined, you know, doing certain things over and over again. And while I was happy to do comedy with him, I didn't want to be, you know, stereotyped as a parody of a Cleveland working stiff, you know.
It's also, you know, troubling too that, you know, he didn't give you an opportunity to speak, he constantly interrupted you as you were about to sort of. I mean, it's like, and again, you know, is it to mock sort of like the working class? That's you know, not that just seems to be an easy shot.
He wants to control. He wants to control his programs. He's kind of a control freak. And also, he's more scared of his bosses than I realized. And I don't know. I just, there was just, after the first couple of shows, there was just no point in doing his program anymore. I wasn't selling any more comics as a result. I wasn't making much money, and I wasn't doing the kind of thing I wanted to do.
But you went on like 8 times, though. I mean...
Yeah, I did go on 8 times, but, you know, there were a couple of really nasty... I was trying to work up to, you know, to talk about GE, and it took a couple of shows to actually get to that point. Mm. And there were a couple of shows where there were really nasty confrontations between Letterman and me, not just the one that was in a movie, but a later one. And it was you know, we just, you know, the last couple of ones that I did, I just did them because the kid who was his producer, you know, really liked me and he wanted me on, and you know, so I said, all right, I'll do it. But I just, you know, I mean, I went on a couple of times, but I didn't want to be bothered with it anymore.
Now, you actually had a blog for a while, both with Joyce and Danielle. I'm wondering why that stopped.
Because they were paying me to do it, and they stopped paying me. I mean, I didn't particularly enjoy doing the blogs. Mm. The reason I did them was because they paid me for them, you know, to promote the movie. When the money stopped, I just quit. I didn't see what was doing me any good.
So basically, you know, you at this point will just accept any kind of writing assignment, basically.
Well, if I get paid for it.
If you get paid, that's what
Yeah. Well, I mean, within reason, I mean, you know, there's some things that I, you know, maybe not competent to write about, or that I'm not interested in writing about, you know. But I'm accepting a lot of writing assignments. I'm very glad to have them.
At the end of the Our Movie Year compilation, you actually have a series of, like, forgotten, you know, musicians and films and literature. Yeah. Since then, have you found any sort of things that kind of, any artists or any works that probably deserve to be recognized that aren't?
Oh, I'm always running across them, but, you know, for now, I mean, I haven't been able to emphasize that, you know. I've been working on these long narratives rather than, you know, like I just did a thing on, what's the name of this
New Orleans Katrina?
No, New Orleans, R&B singer that Fats Domino. I just did a thing on Fats Domino.
Oh, he was missing too.
So, you know, I still do that stuff sometimes, but you know, like a lot of it gets published, like maybe in weekly newspapers, and people don't see it, and then maybe I'll just try and put a whole bunch of them into some anthology I'm doing, because I like those things and I want to get them out again.
What about putting out a book of your jazz criticism or whatever?
Well, you mean the prose jazz criticism?
Yeah, yeah.
No, nobody would put it out. I mean, my jazz criticism is not real entertaining to read. I mean, you have to really, it's pretty serious, and I get into technical things, and I don't think a lot of people would be too crazy about reading it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you've been writing for a long time. You know something about jazz, you know?
Yeah. Well, I also don't. I think I would have a hell of a rough time getting it published, finding someone that would publish it.
Have you tried?
No, I haven't, because I think it would be very difficult, and I'd rather. I mean, it's possible, but it's not one of my big priorities now. I mean, my. You know, I think it might involve a lot of wasted effort. Comics are my main interest right now, and I've got projects on my mind, and I want to, you know, stay with them. You know, I can just spread myself so thin.
Given that you're focusing on these long narratives, are we going to see even longer narratives along the lines of like Box Office Poison or Blankets or something like that? Or
no, I don't. I try not to get into anything that long. I don't think I need that much space to say what I have to say. But yeah, there's another long narrative that I'm working on. Well, I've actually finished a script. It's the artwork is being done. It's about the state, the you know, the political conflict in Macedonia. You know, that used to be a former province of you know, the ex-Yugoslavia.
Wow.
So I'm you know, that's going to be about 150 pages.
Is that the one you were co-writing with Joyce, or?
No, I'm not writing that with Joyce. No, I'm writing a short piece with Joyce, an 8-page story.
There's one, I know we got to get going here, but there's one final question I at least wanted to ask you about. In American Splendor, you sort of frequently refer to yourself as Harvey or Herschel or R-Man as a sort of superhero thing. I was wondering what dictates the specific, you have three different sort of, you know, pieces of nomenclature.
I was just experimenting around. Most of that stuff I did in the early editions of American Splendor. And I don't really do it too much anymore. You know,
you've stopped basically writing about yourself, do you think? Or?
No, I haven't stopped. I still write about myself, but I don't call myself, for example, Herschel.
Yeah.
You know, anymore. And you know, I don't know, maybe it was the fact that since every story was about me, I was a protagonist of every story. Maybe I'm thinking back on it. I'm thinking maybe I did some of that because, you know, referring to myself in different ways so that it would give the overall work more variety, you know. But I don't think I do that much anymore, you know.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is like how you go about selecting your, I mean, you have a sort of team of trusted artists, but is there like a specific story that requires a certain artist or? Well,
I mean, you know, some guys can do some things better than others, and I try and match them up, but the thing is that what often, you know, thwarts me is that, you know, these guys, you know, have other things that they're doing, and not too many of them, especially when I'm working on long projects, you know, can afford to drop everything and work on, you know, especially if they have day gigs, you know, and work on something for a year, you know. So
it's really about like, can they do the job and do they have the time, or is it more do they have the time than?
That's a factor. That's a practical factor.
Harvey Pekar, thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for your interest in my work.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.